Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name's Anne Wilson, and I'm delighted to be hosting this special series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians, people in the public eye, working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and associated overlapping conditions. This season is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign. Designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives, at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. To commence today, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care. A world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions. And dare I dream, a world where we have a cure for these diseases. So today I am delighted to once again welcome and speak with Emerge Australia's Ambassador, Tracy Spicer AM.
Tracy. Anne, that's a beautiful, beautiful introduction. Go on.
Thank you. Tracy is a multiple Walkley Award-winning journalist, author and broadcaster with almost 40 years in the media, launching and anchoring national programs for ABC TV, Network 10 and Sky News. The inaugural national convener of Women in Media, Tracy is one of the most sought-after keynote speakers and MCs in the Asia Pacific on artificial intelligence, social justice, and equity. Her book about AI, Man-Made, How the Bias of the Past is Being Built into the Future, and I've got a copy, was long listed for a prestigious Walkley Award. It won the social responsibility category and was a finalist in the technology category in the Australian Business Book Awards. Tracy is currently on the Global Advisory Board of For Humanity, which convenes the world's smartest minds to reimagine democracy. Oh, how that is needed, Tracy. In 2026, she joined a high-powered delegation to the 70th Commission on the Status of Women at the United Nations headquarters in New York. In 2019, Tracy was named the New South Wales Premier's Woman of the Year, accepted the Sydney Peace Prize with Tarana Burke for the Me Too movement, and won the National Award for Excellence in Women's Leadership through Women in Leadership Australia. ABC TV highlighted Tracy's Me Too work in the docuseries Silent No More. In 2018, Tracy was chosen as one of the Australian Financial Review's 100 Women of Influence, winning the Social Enterprise and Not-for-Profit category. For her 30 years of media and charity work, Tracy has been awarded the Order of Australia. Her first book, The Good Girl Stripped Bare, is a bestseller, while her TED Talk, The Lady Stripped Bare, has attracted almost 7 million views worldwide. Career highlights include documentaries in Bangladesh, Kenya, Uganda, Papua New Guinea and India, and not-for-profit work as an ambassador of ActionAid, the Ethnic Business Women's Foundation, Emerge Australia, and the Australian POTS Foundation, as well as being patron of Pancreatic Cancer Alliance. Wow. How amazing is that? We are honoured, Tracy, A, to have you as our ambassador, and B, to be speaking with you today.
Oh, that's very generous. I'm really in awe of the work that Emerge Australia does. And I know a lot of people with ME/CFS who struggle day to day, and my heart goes out to them. So thank you for the work that you do.
That's our pleasure. So you have clearly a remarkable background. You're actually a remarkable human because you've been through a lot with your own health battles. Can I just start by saying what drew you to accepting our request to become an ambassador for Emerge Australia and to support awareness around ME/CFS?
I think everyone has got their own story when it comes to the challenges they face, particularly when it comes to health. And I learned a lot about ME/CFS when I had long COVID for 2 years. I was in a wheelchair for 10 months. And in a lot of times during those 2 years, I had crashes like a lot of people do. And I learned that I was diagnosed with ME/CFS, with not necessarily POTS, but with a type of dysautonomia, with MCAS, mast cell activation syndrome. And I'm quite sure that down the track, I'll be diagnosed with a few other illnesses that are under the umbrella of all of these post-viral or post-infectious chronic conditions. What really stood out to me at the time was the number of women, particularly young women. I'm not in that category. I'm proudly 59 years of age now, but the number of young women who are struggling with these conditions because of the history of medical misogyny, it's all in your head, little lady, you're just being hysterical. You know, this idea that these are not real conditions. And that lit a fire in my belly, having that lived experience and meeting so many people suffering from similar conditions. I thought we've got to talk about it more, we've got to tell our stories, and we need more research into this.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I think it was last year, I can't remember now, when the federal government announced an amazing amount of investment, like $850 million, which was so welcome, into women's health. And, you know, I was really excited about that. One of the things that has happened is that for people with these energy limiting and overlapping conditions, they're put into a box and they're actually not necessarily included under women's health.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's one of the areas that I'm really keen on, and talking to people like Jed Carney and Tanya Plibersek. The other area, of course, is domestic violence, which we believe in the community of people with energy limiting conditions is an issue, but it flies under the radar. And there's the separation for women of dealing with women's health, which, you know, is menopause, perimenopause, anything to do with endometriosis, etc., all critical, but we're kind of not highlighting that women with ME/CFS and energy limiting conditions also have these other conditions. What are your thoughts about that?
I was so interested to hear at a conference recently about the connection between these energy-limiting conditions and endometriosis, for example, and also the connection with neurodiversity. So there's a lot that we don't yet understand, and these conditions should absolutely be considered under the broader umbrella of women's health because they are so overwhelmingly experienced by women. Having said that, that doesn't preclude men and boys from experiencing these conditions as well, and we need to talk about that because I guess they're not the stereotypical victim survivor of all of this. I was interested when you mentioned domestic violence because often people who are targeted in these cases are vulnerable. And when you have a dynamic disability or an invisible illness, you are most certainly vulnerable. And my heart breaks to think of women in particular and girls in these circumstances because you simply would not have the energy or the ability to be able to do anything about it, to potentially, you know, report the situation or even get out of the situation. Yeah. It's frightening to think of the power imbalance in those circumstances.
Yeah, I think the power imbalance, you know, comes to the fore. And I guess it's really for the future, not quite right now, but for the future, up to organisations like Emerge Australia to really help push the boundaries of our public figures in government to say, you need to look at this patient cohort through the lens of these areas like domestic violence, like broader women's health issues, because that's currently not happening. And, you know, it's not even happening a lot for ME/CFS, to be quite honest, but there's a lot more that's happened in the last couple of years than has happened in the previous 20, which I guess we need to be grateful for small mercies. But from your perspective, you're a prominent public figure, a terrific advocate for so many causes. What do you see as some of the most common misconceptions about ME/CFS, particularly severe cases?
The main misconception that I still hear to this day, although to be fair, there's greater understanding thanks to the good work of Emerge Australia and organisations like it, and also governments having more awareness. But I still hear, oh, it's just tiredness, it's just fatigue. And I know fatigue is in the name of chronic fatigue, and obviously we now call it ME/CFS, but there's still this understanding that you are just tired. And it's a very different feeling in your body. I described it as if my body was a corpse that I was trying to drag around. You feel like you are dead within yourself, if that makes sense. It's more than tiredness. And particularly for people with severe ME, who I think are not spoken about enough, I certainly don't want to speak on behalf of them. I had moderate ME/CFS, but people with ME often get lost in the conversation with severe ME because many of them don't have the energy in their body to be able to digest food, to be able to leave the bed at all. They need 100% care in the home or in a medical institution. And in many cases, the NDIS doesn't recognize it as a condition to support unless they have to jump through an enormous number of hoops, which neither they nor their families have the energy to do. So I think there's a couple of misunderstandings there. One is around the fatigue and tiredness piece, but the other one is around the ability of people suffering from severe ME to be able to advocate for themselves. And that's why the whole community needs to advocate for themselves and their families.
Yeah, that's just such an important point because, you know, we talk about people with ME/CFS having been left out. We talk about them being unseen and unheard, but people with severe ME are just invisible because they are at home in their bed struggling every second of their day exactly the way that you describe. And so it really is up to everybody around and organizations like ours and others to really fly that flag for this most isolated, most debilitated group of people, which we are trying to now highlight during Severe ME Week. So it is really important and gaining traction with the media and with our governments is a challenge. Can you perhaps share thoughts, ideas on how society and the media can better understand and support people living with severe ME?
Having worked in the media for such a long time, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And unfortunately, the media does want an inspirational recovery story. They want the problem-solution narrative. They want the classic story arc. And that's not always the case. You know, they want, I suppose, the perfect victim. We're in every single case, they want to see someone recovering from their journey. And that's not always happening. We need to see the reality, the person who can't get out of bed, who can't tolerate light, who can't tolerate sound, who can't have a conversation, to get really the true horror of this condition across. But the media tends to shy away from things like that because they feel it's too dark, it's too negative, we need to have some kind of solution at the end. But that's where the media and all of us as advocates really need to focus, which is, okay, what is it like a day in the life for someone like this? What is it like for their family members? Can some of the family members speak to what it's like to care for someone with severe ME? You know, we've seen this with different conditions before. It can be done, but it takes a lot of time in educating the media. And unfortunately, media organisations don't have very much funding at the moment. So journalists are busy and rushed, and they tend to be only passionate about this issue if they have experienced it or someone they know has experienced it. So my advice on a way forward is really finding those journalists who are interested, who are passionate, who might know a little bit about it and are open to finding out more about it, and then helping to craft those stories, but with the consent of the person suffering from severe ME and their families, and to do it in a supportive way, because goodness me, dealing with the media is exhausting, whether you have a chronic illness or not. So there's got to be a lot of sensitivity around pitching these stories to the media.
Yeah. Tracy, when I listen to you speak, you know, your passion, obviously your lived experience and your knowledge just shines through. I'm going to ask you a complete sort of off-track message. You were an award-winning journalist, television presenter. At what point in your career did you sort of move into that advocacy space? What made you go there? Because I find that you are one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful advocate that I've ever worked with in my 30 plus years in leadership. You just get it. What led you to make that transition?
That's so generous of you to say that, Anne. But honestly, I think a lot of people think of journalists like they think of used car salespeople. You know, we don't have a very good reputation at this time in history. But I know that many journalists go into the media wanting to advocate, wanting to make a difference. And you can only change hearts and minds through storytelling. And that's at the heart of journalism, getting to the truth, getting to the real kernel, the nugget of the human story that someone might hear and it might change their mind. So I think I've always been a bit of a journalist advocate, but it really amped up, I would say, probably about 30 years ago when I was working in mainstream newsrooms and I saw the inequity, I saw the misogyny, I saw the bullying and the harassment and the terrible treatment of people who had less power by those who were in power. It was a really toxic work environment. When you extrapolate that to broader society, you see the number of people who are suffering every single day, not just in TV newsrooms. So that was what lit the fire in my belly all those years ago. And also, you know, coming from a position of privilege, being a white person working in the media, realizing I had power, and if I couldn't use that power to help others, then what was the point? What was the point of the job? You know, what was the point of having a voice if you can't use it to lift up other voices? Then when I had the long COVID, I'd never had an experience of disability before. And it is true that you can have an understanding as someone without a disability, but when you are in the wheelchair, when you realize that a wheelchair-friendly venue has a step halfway between where you are and where you need to go, you realize the daily struggles of people who don't live the way that many people who design our cities and buildings live. I mean, one in five people with a disability, and I do strongly believe that the next big conversation society will have is around invisible illness and dynamic disability, because I was abused when I was out publicly in my wheelchair and then I would stand up because I had to stand up to do something, and people would say, oh, there's a fake disabled person, she's standing up out of her wheelchair. I am grateful to see things like the sunflower symbol in a lot of airports around the world now and in Australia. So there is a greater understanding that just because you don't look like someone with a disability, you might still be experiencing it. And I guess to answer your question, that's the other reason I'm so powerful about advocacy, is because I do look at the big picture. I see things moving forward, even though it's frustrating from the day to day, we do go in the right direction over time.
Yeah, that's so reassuring to hear. And as you were talking, I was thinking that in that 30-year career, what we've also seen is so many more female journalists in the business. You know, it's not a male-dominated field, at least not from the angle of reporters. You know, so many reporters now are female, and that helps to create the perception that the balance of power is shifting a little bit, even though I'm pretty sure it's still at the most senior levels male dominated. But we do see a lot more women. And I know that in Emerge Australia's tiny little media journalism awards, we're getting a pretty good balance, probably going the other way, of a lot of female journalists that are writing articles and entering our awards. So the issue of power and control and gender balance is certainly something that is slowly, you know, infiltrating some of the priorities that we look at in the areas of energy limiting disease. So fascinating. Sorry, I had to go off on that tangent.
No, I'm absolutely connected, because there are more female journalists. We see more stories about women's health, because that is the good aspect of unconscious bias. We all have unconscious bias, but if there are more women, they'll cover stories that impact other women. And that's a really welcome change.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll switch now to the Australian government. This is just such a hard question. In your view, what kind of messages should be communicated to the Australian government, to the powers that be, in this very complex geopolitical world that we are living in, to ensure that the needs of those with severe ME are prioritised and adequately addressed?
Well, quite simply, we need to fund ME research at a level that matches its prevalence, because it is highly prevalent. Even though a lot of it's invisible, the numbers are compelling. And it's historically been under-resourced, like a lot of illnesses that affect predominantly populations of women and girls. We need the funding into the research. We need the focus. We need to mandate more clinician education, really, so GPs stop dismissing and misdiagnosing patients. You know, I don't want to criticize all doctors, but the gaslighting is real. I experienced it. I think pretty much everybody watching or listening to this would have experienced it as well. And that just takes extra spoonfuls of energy. Mandating that education, I mean, Where is the drawback on that? Education is what changes things. And GPs get educated in all different sorts of conditions. So why not this? Because of the rate of it within the community. And we also need to ensure that Medicare and NDIS pathways actually work for people who are unable to leave the home, that they have access to the NDIS and also to bulk billing and to GP visits in the home, because there are so many hurdles that need to be overcome. So, you know, advocacy is tricky. I don't want to criticise the government too much. I know there's greater understanding. I know they're trying to do a lot with a limited budget. But what I would say is, by golly, if they want the vote of a vast number of people, particularly women and girls, there are so many families impacted by this. So please support these families in their time of need. We will not forget it.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree with you more. And of course, at Emerge Australia, you know, we do a lot of clinical education that we receive zero financial support for from government, which we are constantly trying to negotiate. And one of the challenges that I believe our clinicians face, and when we say we deliver clinical education, it is to provide support to the clinicians, because so many of them have not been trained in their undergraduate training in anything to do with energy limiting conditions, let alone ME/CFS, and of course, let alone anything to do with COVID. So, you know, the undergraduate training is an area that we're trying to impact through a medical and scientific advisory committee. But then we do go with our clinicians to clinical education opportunities where we can have a presentation for 30 minutes or 50 minutes to a room full of clinicians. And then we have a stand like you do at conferences. And honestly, Tracy, I cannot begin to tell you how many clinicians over the last 4 years that we've been going to these conferences say things to me like, COVID doesn't exist. I don't want to see patients with ME/CFS. They take too much time. I had one clinician say to me recently, I don't need to know about ME/CFS. Because I work in aged care.
Oh, for goodness sake. Look, that's ridiculous. But what you touch on is really important around the structural issue, you know, how doctors are paid and rewarded for the shorter consultation period. And it's incredibly difficult to diagnose anyone with ME/CFS in that period of time. So you're right, it's a deeper structural issue rather than just a not wanting to know. Yes, some of them don't want to know by the sound of it. I'm horrified by that. But there's also, they're not rewarded for knowing.
And it is a structural issue. And to their credit, the federal government did about 12, 14 months ago change one of the item numbers for greater remuneration for longer consultations. Tick. But we still have the systemic issues around, and this is particularly affecting people with severe ME, that they need to go and see their GP at least once a year for a face-to-face contact before they can access telehealth.
Wow.
So, of course, someone who has severe ME, who is unable to leave their home, who isn't able to access a home visit because home visits are really very unpopular, they don't go to see their GP. So it's not unusual for us to hear from people with severe ME, oh, I haven't seen a doctor for ages because I can't access telehealth.
It's just terrible. And then layer on top of that, people who live in rural, regional and remote areas who would struggle to find a GP anyway, let alone a GP who's educated in these areas, because often the younger GPs are sent out there, the less experienced ones. And then if they can't even access telehealth or face-to-face at all, if they have problems with connectivity, for example, there are multifaceted challenges here.
Yeah, absolutely. Which kind of leads me to the next question that is about mobilising community and political support to improve services for people with these conditions, and obviously also funding for ME research and care. In your vast experience, have you got any little nuggets that you could share or any thoughts that you've got about this area?
This is one of the joys of being almost 60, because you do see a lot of things change over time. For example, when I was younger, we never spoke about breast cancer. We never spoke about breasts, right? We never spoke about ovarian cancer. We didn't really speak about women's health that much. We never spoke about periods. My goodness. And now there's so much conversation about that, about perimenopause, about menopause. So I am confident that that exquisite balance and combination of storytelling and direct advocacy with members within the government who are open to the conversation, which I know is something that Emerge Australia is phenomenal at, that is how we will move forward. And I call it an exquisite balance because, yes, we've got to get the stories there in the media. Yes, we should rightly criticise the government for what they've done wrong, but equally we've got to bring the people in power who are within government along the journey as well. So it is a bit of a balance of saying, here's how we can do it better, and providing a pathway for people who've got power. You know, the combination of, I guess, government decision making and philanthropy and not-for-profit fundraising and the community coming together. The research shows globally that, you know, how do things change? Believe it or not, it's not top down, it's bottom up. The greatest change in the world, whether it comes to civil rights movement or women's rights movements, comes from grassroots communities joining together to create change. And that's why I genuinely have hope, because we've done it before as a society and we can do it again.
Yeah, I think that's really absolutely brilliant advice for an organisation like Emerge Australia, because it is the voices of people with lived experience. They may not always agree, especially between organisations, and that's just another area of challenge in my field. But if we unite the voices of people with lived experience to build a movement that says this has to change, and then we work with our elected officials in Parliament to create that change, it will happen. And I guess a little bit like you, I think one of the joys of getting older and having had a bit of life experience means that you've lived through cycles where nothing is really new. All you're really doing is joining the dots to a different story. And I find that incredibly exciting. It's probably the most exciting part of the work that I do, being able to go, oh, yeah, I've seen this before. Why don't we join this dot with that dot and then put something? So I think that is, you know, starting from the ground up is just, I mean, there's nothing to say that you don't work at both ends at the same time, which I think ultimately is the solution, because then we get to that middle ground. I also think that in this time, as I spoke before, of such geopolitical unrest, I do have a little bit of sympathy for and empathy with our elected government officials. It must be tough when you have to be thinking about protecting the nation, you know, and national security against, oh, a little organisation like Emerge Australia saying, look at me, we need to do things better for people with ME. So there needs to be a bit of an understanding, but certainly at times like this, especially in Emerge Australia's history, we do need government to say, we're looking, we see you, and we hear the voices of people with lived experience, and we will respond. So I guess that's the world that I live in right now.
You mentioned joining the dots, because one thing I think a lot about is that quote that to have a healthy democracy and society, we must protect and support our most vulnerable. So there is a connection between supporting an organisation like Emerge Australia and geopolitics. It creates a healthier, more stable, thriving country longer term. Yeah. And part of that is shining a light to make the invisible visible. And that's what we're talking about. And any government that does that will be absolutely ahead of the game, because effectively that's their job, to bring the country forward.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What a powerful statement that is. So I've got two final questions. One relates to public awareness campaigns, and you would have seen many from many organisations. How do you see the role of public awareness campaigns in changing health policy? And I guess specifically for this particular podcast, for those with severe symptoms who, as you say, are invisible. Our job is to make the invisible visible, but there are a lot of invisible conditions that are vying for that visibility. What do you see the role of public awareness campaigns in that?
Well, this is where I'm highly optimistic, because previously, if you wanted to do a campaign, you had to partner with a major media organisation. That was the only pathway forward.
Yes.
These days, you can do it more quickly, more easily, and with less energy expenditure from the person living with severe ME through different social media campaigns and through any kind of viral or image-based video, rather, or image-based content. And look, if you're lucky enough for a campaign to go viral, that's obviously what everyone dreams of. But, you know, the most important thing really is to put a face to these illnesses, to make them visible. And if that means that there has to be less energy expenditure from the patient and their families, and if it can be shorter social media clips, that is a great way to build a groundswell of support. You don't necessarily need the mainstream media anymore. Yes, they're very helpful for the credibility piece, that's true, but there are numerous pathways these days for advocates, for lived experience survivors, and for the community. And I would encourage everybody, depending on how many spoonfuls you've got, to join that movement, even if it is the families of the people experiencing severe ME, if they're unable to do any of this stuff. Every little bit helps, and it joins together in that tapestry of the work of advocates to, you know, get the message to the community and to governments. It's absolutely crucial.
I just love what you've just said, because the minute you started saying that, it took me right back to my days as CEO of Asthma Australia, and then my long-term association with Kidney Health Australia, and how running a campaign has changed in that period of time, which is a long period of time. You know, I wouldn't have dreamt of being able to very quickly get a campaign out in front of either government and or the community like we do now through social media. You just, you know, it just wasn't on the horizon 20 or 25 years ago. But it's so different now. I even remember my first appointment as a CEO, sitting down in front of a computer at my brand new office, but not being able to send an email. When you look at how technology has evolved, It has in fact made the lives of organisations like ours easier to connect with a very large number of people. And so it does give hope that we are able, through being up to date with technology, change the perceptions of the community, of those people in power, and also those people whom we can influence to provide financial support for the work that we do. And of course, you know, Emerge Australia is not alone there. We're a tiny dot in the landscape of organisations in the charitable space that are all trying to do the same, which is a shame, really, because there's, you know, so much competition out there, but you got to be in it to win it, I reckon.
Yeah, that's right. Look, it's a competitive space, but the barrier to entry for social media amplification is increasingly low. It's easy and cheap to be able to get the message out on what we used to call new media. So yes, it's competitive, but it's also easier to be able to access rather than the old gatekeepers of mainstream media. So I guess there's swings and roundabouts in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. Tracy, finally, in this week of severe ME, is there a message of hope you'd like to send to all the families and to the broader community around how people cope? What message of hope would you have out there for this community on Severe ME Day, which is actually the 8th of August?
To everyone living with severe ME and your families, I want you to know that you are seen, you are heard, and you are loved. You might feel like you're invisible, but there is a community that is wrapping its arms around you and supporting you in any way that we can. Thank you for your perseverance and your patience in waiting for society to catch up to what you have understood for so long. You are incredibly wise, and we need to listen to your lived experience and learn from it. My message for hope is this, that we know, in fact, the great Martin Luther King Jr. said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, we are learning more about this condition, and we are getting there one day at a time. So thank you for sharing your stories.
Thank you, Tracy. What a beautiful way to end this podcast. Thank you for your time, for your willingness to share your personal story and your views and experiences. They're invaluable to those listening, but they're also invaluable to me as CEO of Emerge Australia and to our organisation. We really do appreciate you being our ambassador and supporting us in the way that you do. So thank you.
Oh, no, thank you for everything you do, Anne, in leading Emerge Australia. When I had my long COVID, I learned so much from your organisation. It was absolutely, you know, life-changing. So thank you for everything you and the team do.
That's our pleasure. So today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series recorded for Severe ME Week in 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and overlapping conditions in Australia. As Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle and we prepare to seek renewed investment, Emerge Australia is proud to launch the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patient services, dedicated ME research, clinical education, and health policy change for Australians living with these conditions. Through Count ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatised conditions and provide critical insights to equip decision makers, ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. Thank you again, Tracy, so very much for joining me for our podcast today. And to those listening in, tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information, to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or find out how you can support our work, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Thanks again, Tracy, and bye for now.
Thank you, Anne. Bye-bye.
You may say that I'm a dreamer. and the world.